An employee with the Lake Washington School District is in ICE custody. The district confirming that Fernando Rocha, a theater manager at Juanita High School, appears to have been detained.
White men in America are 45 more times likely to commit a violent crime than an immigrant. And we got to appeal to these white voters. Ron, the only people that appealed to those white voters was Joe Biden at 81 years old.
We have great confidence in our son. I am not concerned about any accusations been made against him. It's used to get to me. He's a grown man. He is the smartest man I know.
The morning ride on a Tuesday. We're taking conservatives to work and liberal progressive Democrats to task for their dysfunctional politics so that we can make Washington livable again. Going to get into the Hunter Biden F-bomb spree. This interview he did where he just basically scorched earth on just about everybody in Democratic political circles. So,
the type of interview a sober man does.
Is that how to explain it? Yeah, I've heard lots of jokes that I guess Hunter Biden hasn't laid off the cocaine. So that's one of the other takeaways. Yes, cocaine is a hell of a drug, as Rick James once said. So that's one of the things that we'll get into. At the bottom of the hour, I've got a story about an ICE arrest on San Juan Island. And now the husband and wife, the guy gets arrested between the husband and wife. Now they're crying foul that he never should have been arrested. I will go through the story and you can decide for yourself if you think ICE has a reasonable cause to arrest this individual on San Juan Island. And then in the clip I just played for you to start off, we've got another case of an ICE arrest, and it involves a staffer, not a teacher, but a staffer at Juanita High School in Kirkland, someone who is described as the theater manager for Juanita High School, is in ICE custody now, or seems to have been arrested by ICE. And State Senator Monka Dhingra is intervening on his behalf. And Monka Dhingra is making a claim about his immigration status that would seem to contravene an arrest. So, like I said, we've got two more of these cases where either the family of the person arrested, or in this case, a state senator from Redmond, is saying that this person never should have been arrested. So we'll sort through some of that coming up at the bottom of the hour here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. The other story I want to start with is what happened with the WNBA All-Star Game over the weekend. The WNBA All-Star Game would normally focus around a couple of the top players in the league. Caitlin Clark would be one of those, but she was injured and did not play. But the WNBA players wore T-shirts as part of the warm-up that really captured all the attention of what was going on with the WNBA All-Star Game and sort of completely overshadowed anything related to the actual game. Players, the WNBA All-Star Game, walked out in T-shirts that said, "Pay us what you owe us." And this is a complaint that the WNBA women, the salary of what they collect in relation to what the league spends is only 9% of what the league spends. And in the NBA, the male players, their combined salaries are something like 50% of what the league spends. And so the WNBA players are complaining that they should be getting payroll that's equivalent to that 50% level that the men in the NBA have. One problem, the WNBA loses money. It does not clear a profit. It does not generate more money than it spends. And so after the game, one of the WNBA All-Stars is a former UW player. And her name is Kelsey Plum. And she was a very accomplished University of Washington Husky women's basketball player. And she talked about how they came up with this T-shirt that said, "Pay us what you owe us." And then she made kind of an interesting disclosure that Caitlin Clark, kind of the one of the two or three most popular players in the league, Caitlin Clark didn't really offer any input into this. And Kelsey Plum seemed to take a verbal shot at Caitlin Clark, one of the more high-profile players in the WNBA. Listen up.
Well, it was a very powerful moment. We didn't, at least as players, we didn't know that that was going to happen. So I think it was kind of like a genuine surprise. But the T-shirt, just United Front, was determined this morning that we had a meeting for. And, you know, not to tattletale, but zero members of Team Clark were very present for that. But no, we were just, we had a very...
that really needed to be mentioned.
So that's the voice of another WNBA All-Star player that was at this post-game press conference. And she's kind of saying, yeah, you didn't need to mention that.
I'm trying to make a situation light, okay? But yeah, no, I think it was just all of us getting on the same page for the game. We wanted to do something that was just united and collective, and I thought that it was a very powerful moment and got the point across, and, you know, sometimes you don't have to say anything.
So that's what University of Washington Husky Kelsey Plum, WNBA All-Star player, is saying about what inspired these shirts. These shirts that said, pay us what you owe us. And, of course, as soon as these shirts were seen, it started spreading on wildfire on social media, and people kept pointing out, okay, but the WNBA loses money every year. And I think it's never made money in the entire lifespan of the WNBA. And as you start up a business, that's not uncommon. You have to take losses for several years, build up your audience, and build up your revenue streams. And part of this is going to revolve around a media contract for WNBA games. And apparently a more lucrative WNBA contract is about to kick in. But that will obviously influence how much the WNBA players ultimately get paid. But this protest at the All-Star game, you know, slogans on shirts, it kind of harkens back to what we saw in the aftermath of George Floyd murder, that social justice messages, pro athletes and things like that started taking place on shirts for pro athletes as they went out to do warm-ups so they could share whatever their social justice message. So it has those same parallels from a couple of years ago. But this whole pay us what you owe us T-shirt slogan is an object lesson in socialism. And the way to solve this is, hey, ladies at the WNBA, go ask all of your colleagues at the NBA, the male players, to just fork over some of their salary directly to you. That would be the object lesson of socialism here, because that's what the WNBA players are asking for. They're asking for money that they don't have. They're hopeful that media contract-wise, the WNBA starts to bring in more revenue, and some of that revenue will come back to them. I'm imagining that it will. I don't know that it's going to give them up to that 50% salary or expenditure level that the NBA currently enjoys. But there's all kinds of great reaction to what the WNBA players were trying to lobby for with these pay us what you owe us shirts. And here's one of them. This issue shows that there are two types of people in America: those who understand how business works and those who don't. You can't pay money you aren't generating. Another one says NBA players make 50% of league's revenues. WNBA players make about 9% of the league's revenues. And this is a person who's supportive of the pay us what you owe us slogan, saying the WNBA players are not asking for equal pay. They're only asking for a larger share of the league's revenues. And that person sums it up saying, not hard to grasp. But again,
you're not the league.
Yeah, the amounts of money that we're talking about here are drastically different. And then here's another economic problem question for the WNBA and the WNBA fans. And somebody added, if women supported the WNBA the same way that men support the NBA, they would probably be making the money that they are lobbying for with these shirts. The fact is that women will never watch sports the same way men do. Women don't care about sports. They care about the politics of an issue like this. And this comes back to Megan Rapinoe, who's got a Seattle connection, Portland connection, Megan Rapinoe, when she was demanding equal pay for women's national soccer team members, that they should get paid the same as the men do because it's the same work. Although the international pool of money, usually connected to the World Cup for men's and women's international soccer, is exponentially bigger for the men's side than the women's side. And that kind of comes back to this post I just read you, that if women supported women's international soccer the same way men support men's international soccer, then you might have similar revenues to work with. You got to remember, men and women, it's basically, you know, more or less give or take a 51, 49, or 50-50 demographic split. But guys are much more likely to give their disposable income to sports athletes, you know, watching games, buying tickets, either going to bars and things like that, buying jerseys, things like that. So that's definitely an aspect of all of this. And then I thought, okay, coming back to this idea of what do women watch, what do men watch, how that affects how much money the NBA players, as an example, and the WNBA players in comparison, how that all shakes out. And so I did a little bit of searching, did some internet searching, some AI type searching, and I wanted to compare what you get with WNBA game ratings on TV, because that's going to be a big driver of how much money is coming into the WNBA. Media contracts, ticket sales are one part, but media broadcast rights, those are a big factor for any professional sports league. And so let's find out what viewership is like for WNBA games, and let's compare it to something else that's pretty popular. I'm going to guess, I don't watch the reality TV show The Bachelor, the franchise The Bachelor, but from what I hear, it's pretty popular with the ladies, right?
That's what I've been told.
It's targeted at a female viewing audience. So when I did some searching in this comparison of how many people are watching WNBA games, how many people are watching The Bachelor, here's what I found out. WNBA games between ESPN and ABC average about 1.3 million viewers. That is up 10% from a year ago. Some WNBA games have attracted bigger audiences, and they point out one that reached 2.7 million viewers. And that was the most watched WNBA game since 2000. It says even games without Caitlin Clark can draw considerable viewership. Back on June 7th, a game between the Fever, I'm trying to think, is that...
That's Caitlin Clark's
that's
team.
Caitlin Clark, the Indiana team. And the Chicago Sky, 1.92 million viewers. So just under 2 million viewers. Now, for The Bachelor, season 28 finale had an initial live plus same-day audience, so they're factoring in people that might watch it on a time delay, of 4.1 million viewers. So easily double. And 3 days of platform viewing, including the streaming, that number grew to 6.3 million viewers. So now you're talking three times as many viewers in some cases. So one of the Bachelor contestants, Joey Graziati, his season premiere attracted 6 million viewers after 7 days of viewing across both linear and streaming platforms.
With a much smaller staff.
Is this back to the Stephen Colbert?
No. Just this. Oh. The amount of people that need to be paid out to air an episode of The Bachelor is far fewer than the amount of people you have to pay out for the entirety of the WNBA.
Yeah, now I'm with you.
Because even though the one game, you know, accrues X amount of viewers, you still are, you know, working that money out from across both teams and the broadcasts. Right.
So I guess what we need to do is have contestants from The Bachelor start coaching WNBA teams.
Oh, there you go.
And maybe that would solve some of the problem. Maybe that would help the WNBA players get what they're owed. I'm just trying to solve problems here. I'm trying to be helpful.
I'm going to say it. I think they'd prefer to be on The Bachelorette.
The Bachelorette? The Bachelor contestants would?
No, the WNBA players.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see where you're going with that. I'll just leave it at that. But I think I see where you're going with that. And I think that there probably is another slight twist to this, and that's ABC is probably available to be seen in more homes than, say, a combination of ABC, cable, ESPN, WNBA games. So I'll stipulate that that's a factor here in how some of the ratings come together and why The Bachelor gets a larger audience. But it still comes back to who is the target audience of this, and how is it going to generate an audience? And if the WNBA players say, pay us what you owe us, a lot of that is going to revolve around the audience that you draw. You draw a bigger audience, you're going to get more money. If you don't, you won't. Pretty simple.
Frankly, hard to have a lot of sympathy. Or there's bigger problems in this world to solve. The average salary I looked up for a WNBA player, the average salary is a hair over $100,000 a year.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
and, you know, pointing that out, do you remember the Brittany Griner controversy and whole international drama a couple years ago? She ended up getting detained in Russia because the WNBA players were going to play overseas in the offseason so that they could pick up more money and make more money in some of these foreign leagues. And then, of course, Brittany Griner got caught with whatever it was, the hash oil or whatever it was, and then just got detained permanently in Russia. And it wasn't because she had hash oil or whatever it was. It was because she was a pawn that the Vladimir Putin regime could use to hold over the United States. But that was the reason that
WNBA players were doing that. My point, too, is that you have an off season. You don't have to go play basketball in Russia. You're making $100,000 a year, and you have months worth of an off season to go pursue whatever sort of other endeavor you might want to. So
I suppose podcasting sort of opens up for something like that in the off season for those WNBA players too. That's always a possibility. But just this whole idea that the WNBA players are asking for money that's not there. I don't have any doubts that once this new broadcast contract kicks in, broadcast rights contract does, the money will start to bump up. I don't think it's going to get to the NBA level, but this is all strictly supply and demand, and it shows you this dysfunction that
if viewership is up 10%, salary might go up
probably,
10%.
Yeah, exactly. But the dysfunction that we seem to have over understanding socialism versus market forces. Okay. One more follow-up to what we were just talking about with the WNBA and the whole socialism thing. This is the question the next time you have one of these conversations with somebody about Zoran Mamdani or a candidate like that running for office, Zoran Mamdani running for mayor of New York City. This is The Morning Ride here, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I'm your host, Phil Vandervoort. And the question would be for somebody who is supportive of Zoran Mamdani. Just ask a simple question. When the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, which side did people run to? Did they run from the East German side to the West German side, or did they run from the West German side to the East German side? And then see how they respond. That would be the best test case for somebody like Zoran Mamdani. You get an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in there, some of the Seattle political activist types, your Antifa types. Just ask him that question. Which side did people run to after the Berlin Wall fell down? And see what they kind of have to say to that, because they'll either show you one of two things. they will show you that they don't really have an answer, or if they give you an answer, chances are it's probably going to be historically ignorant. All right, here are The Morning Ride on a Tuesday. Coming up to start the 7 o'clock hour, I've got a guest that's going to join me regarding a lawsuit in Seattle over something called the Mandatory Housing Affordability Program. And suffice to say, the attempts to try and make housing affordable is turning out to be very expensive. And I'll bring you that story as we start off the 7 o'clock hour here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Other than that, a couple of great local stories coming up at 6:35 and 7:35 I want you to be here for, too. We've talked a little bit about how crime has been increasing in the in Pierce County, and a lot of it seems to revolve around Spanaway and Parkland. And I know this is Zach's old stomping grounds. This isn't far from my stomping grounds when I was younger growing up in Tacoma, West Tacoma. But there was an arrest of two juvenile car theft suspects, and a third one is still on the run, and the age of the third one hasn't been disclosed yet. But you've got a 14 and a 15-year-old that were just arrested, and it all stemmed from three people seen wearing ski masks driving around in Parkland. Here's a story from Como 4's Preston Phillips. This is going to start off with some of the officer body cam audio video. So this was the heat of the moment as the sheriff's deputy ended up moving in for the arrest on these juvenile car theft suspects.
Get out of the car. They're all masked up. Get out of the car.
Deputies arrest two teens accused of stealing a car with another teen in Parkland early Saturday morning. Right around 4 a.m., deputies spotted the car being driven at a high rate of speed down Pacific Avenue with all three teens wearing ski masks. The 14 and 15-year-old suspects took off running after a traffic stop, but deputies caught two of them, one behind a barbed wire fence. The third is still on the run tonight. The stolen car's ignition was damaged, and the driver was found with screwdrivers in his pocket.
So the kids can't read or math at grade level, but they're apparently pretty good at getting cars that do not belong to them to start without keys and by using screwdrivers, apparently.
It's a vocational program.
So this is a big step forward, I think. That is a bright sign for Pierce County and 14 and 15-year-olds. And so you've got a third suspect there that's still at large.
They could be playing Grand Theft Auto or doing Grand Theft Auto.
Yes.
Take your pick.
I was just going to say, there's this reference that I have not had anyone use it personally with me, but I've heard other people use it about other kids that stay inside, stay online, stay tethered to the phone or the computer. It's called touching grass. Have you heard this phrase?
No.
That if you went outside and you actually did something like, you know, played spike ball or played frisbee golf
or stole a car.
Went to the park or something like that, or went just even left the house to go see a movie as an example. I touched grass today. That this is something that comes up commonly with the
kids are bragging about it now.
The Zoomers, right? Exactly, the Zoomers, and you're on it right there. You can either play Grand Theft Auto or you can go do Grand Theft Auto. That's definitely a component of the story as well, but. Another case, juvenile crime, Pierce County in this case. So one suspect still on the run after stealing that vehicle in Spanaway. Well, the text line has heated up quickly this morning between the WNBA salaries, the socialism, and my analogy about the Berlin Wall. Let's see. We've got Nancy says, I love the Berlin Wall analogy. My thought was, why was there a Berlin Wall? To keep people out of a country or keep people in it? And then another one says, this is Richard in Northern Virginia said, quite clear, none of the WNBA players were math or econ majors in college. So great input. Thank you for that. You can add your comments as the show proceeds, 206-421-5757.
Richard has earned himself a rim shot.
Yeah, he gets it. A little slight delay there. Let's go to the replay on that text message. Okay. Thank you for the text messages at 206-421-5757.
The WNBA can't afford a replay cam.
Hopefully they don't do the kiss hug cam.
Oh.
All right. We're still doing that joke. Okay. Seattle Times has another I can't believe I got arrested by ICE story. And it's not to say that Seattle Times is always doing these stories. It's just that this one happens to come from the Seattle Times. So I'll give you that disclaimer here.
Another one.
But, yeah, I've been watching these pop up, and I feel like they need to be discussed. Because the devil's in the details on so many of these ICE arrest stories. The Seattle Times headline says, pregnant woman fights for husband detained in Washington by ICE. So let me give you some of the particulars here. 35-year-old man, Guilherme Gui Silva. Gui is kind of a nickname, short for Guilherme. Brazilian guy, but he's here in the U.S. He had a travel visa to come to the U.S., and that will be a little foreshadowing for the heart of this story. He's a 35-year-old husband. He's the father of an expected baby boy due to be born in October, and he was arrested by ICE officers on San Juan Island. The Seattle Times reports that his wife, who's from the San Francisco Bay Area, her name is Rachel Liedig, she got a surprise phone call from an unknown number in the 360 area code. Her husband was calling from an Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency holding room in Bellingham. Silva, the husband, moved from Brazil to the United States about 8 years ago, told his wife that about six or seven unmarked ICE vehicles surrounded his car on San Juan Island here in early July. Shortly after, he left his cabin there to pick up his four-year-old daughter from her grandmother in Friday Harbor. The Seattle Times story says masked ICE agents emerged from the vehicles, pulled Silva from his car, confiscated his cell phone, detained him, his wife said. When Silva, who worked as an attorney in Brazil, asked to be shown an arrest warrant, one of the ICE officers refused, according to what Liedig, the wife, was told by her husband. So again, some second, third-hand information. The wife, Liedig, is a U.S. citizen, and she works as a makeup hairstyle artist in San Francisco. So that's where she is. She's trying to keep her husband, Silva, from getting deported and permanently separated from her, his four-year-old girl, and future son. The wife said Silva has no criminal record and no outstanding warrants, and shortly after they married back in April, he hired an immigration lawyer to apply for a green card. San Juan County District Court records show that Silva was fined $100 for a speeding ticket late last year, the late part of 2024. Last week, it would have been Thursday, Liedig saw her husband, Silva, for the first time since he was detained on July 11th. So if last week was the 17th, last Thursday was the 17th, that means he was detained for about six, 7 days. And he ultimately got transferred to the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma. The wife said her husband told her he has met other detainees who say they have been held there for months without court dates and unable to get legal representation despite having green cards. So, again, some second, third-hand information. The wife said to the Seattle Times, this is a nightmare. There is no such thing as due process. The Seattle Times writes, ICE did not respond to inquiries last Thursday or Friday. In an email on Friday, the Department of Homeland Security said that in November 2016, Silva, the husband, was issued a B-2 visa, which allows non-U.S. citizens to temporarily enter the country for tourism, pleasure, or medical treatment. The agency said Silva was arrested because he did not leave the U.S. when his visa expired in March 2017. Oops. Oh, I guess the wife forgot that part about the expired travel visa.
He's got paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. is it current?
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah.
So, how about new?
You know, is this a portion of the story that could have been higher up? I'm like halfway through the Seattle Times story, and the I forgot to leave when the visa expired part comes up. So continuing with what the Seattle Times reports, Silva lives in San Francisco when he's not on San Juan Island to be with his daughter, earned a law degree in Brazil, but realized he had a passion for art, so he decided to become a professional muralist, developing his own colorful, bright style, inspired by his Brazilian upbringing. How quaint. Silva started dating a woman, and the couple eventually married and had their now four-year-old daughter, according to the current wife. So this is a previous relationship. And Silva's former wife sponsored his first green card application, but they ended up getting divorced. And she withdrew her sponsorship for that green card application, apparently, when the marriage dissolved. And then the Brazilian fellow, who is detained now by ICE, met current wife in August 2023, and then they got married earlier this year. Now, during a phone call after the husband, Silva, was arrested by ICE, the wife said Silva told her he left his home on San Juan Island that morning to pick up his daughter when he noticed a black SUV parked nearby on a private road. He told the wife the car seemed to follow him as he drove toward Friday Harbor, and after he turned onto the main road about six other unmarked vehicles ambushed him, according to the wife, ambushed him. After being told they didn't need to show him a warrant, an agent grabbed Silver from his car, took his cell phone out of his hand, pushed him against the car, according to what the husband told the wife. Silva told his wife he asked the agents why they were detaining him. Two agents gave him a different answer. They took him off the island on the private boat, and that's how he ended up in the ICE holding center in Bellingham. He was ultimately transferred down to Tacoma. At one point that day, he told his wife that ICE agents made him take off all of his clothes so that they could inspect any tattoos he might have, asking him if they were gang-related. And he spent the next 38 hours in the Ferndale ICE holding room, sleeping on the floor with about 35 other people, according to the wife. He was transported down to the ICE processing center in Tacoma. Now, the wife tells the Seattle Times her husband, nicknamed Gooey, Gooey's not part of a gang. He never has been. It's just crazy. They don't care who they're arresting or if they have a background. They're just trying to get their numbers up. And what she's getting at here, he's not part of a gang. Nobody's saying that he's in a gang, lady. They're merely checking tattoos as a probably a precautionary measure. So I think that explains the asking to see the arms and legs based on any possible tattoos. A July 29th hearing is now scheduled, according to the wife, for some sort of immigration hearing. So he was arrested on the 11th. He's getting a July 29th hearing. And she's complaining there's no due process. That's about 17, 18 days. That's not out of the ordinary. And their immigration attorney plans to request that the husband, Silva, be released on bond on the 29th of July next week and allow him to return back to San Francisco near their Bay Area home. So a little bit of short-term memory loss on the travel visa overstay. Maybe that's why ICE moved in and ended up looking at this guy for an arrest. And then you combine that short-term memory loss with this reflexive criticism about lack of due process. And none of these things are out of the ordinary right now. And, you know, if you're upset about this arrest and the time it takes to get an immigration judge to hear your case, this might be why you should consider sporting something like the One Big Beautiful Bill and any way there is to increase the amount of immigration judges to hear these cases more expeditiously. But this is another one of these stories, this one coming out of the Seattle Times, of a woe is me, I can't believe I got arrested by ICE, and completely overlooking that someone overstayed a 2017 visa. Now go to Juanita High School. We've got this report. I first saw about this. Jonathan Cho, digital journalist Jonathan Cho, was reporting on this. And now Fox 13 has picked up the story. Here's some of Fox 13's coverage.
An employee with the Lake Washington School District is in ICE custody. The district confirming that Fernando Rocha, a theater manager at Juanita High School, appears to have been detained. The district releasing a statement saying that they have been in contact with Rocha to provide appropriate employment documentation.
So that's Fox 13 reporter Maria Garcia. And then she adds this little element about State Senator Monka Dhingra, a Democrat, that's apparently working with the detained theater manager from Juanita High School and that guy's attorney. Let's get that queued up for you.
State Senator Monka Dhingra and her office are also working to help him, according to the state senator's office. He is here legally and has never actually been arrested.
So Monka Dhingra is saying this guy's here legally, but he's been arrested. Is this story going to hold up? Is Monka Dhingra going to be proven wrong on this? I want to see what happens with this story. And like I've talked about before, if you've got a wrongful arrest situation and this guy is in the country legally, but he got arrested or detained by ICE, I'm sure Monka Dhingra would probably be happy to represent him in court and take ICE to court for whatever happened. So let's see where that story goes. And if Monka Dhingra turns out to be accurate or not based on this claim she's apparently now making to Fox 13 News. It's good to get Lars Larson back here on Talk Radio 570 KVI after a couple of days of vacation. The Morning Ride for you on a Tuesday. Phil Vandervoort here. Lars Larson, our midday host, noon to three, joining me here on the ride. Hi, Lars.
Hey, good morning. I took my granddaughter out to the farm, and we worked for, well, we didn't work for all 4 days. We did have some fun, but we went to Bald Eagle Days in Cathlamet, which is a great little town.
No kidding.
Not too far from the farm. Yeah, Bald Eagle Days. And I'll tell you, almost every, we've been going out there every weekend since September when we got this little 8 acres and a decrepit farmhouse that was ready to fall down, literally.
Yeah.
And we've been saving it. But we see bald eagles almost every day.
That's glorious. There. Yeah, that's
beautiful.
You've told me a little bit about what you're putting into that property, and it sounds fantastic as a great place for the family to be.
A lot of sweat. But you, what's nice is a small town of... Sweat equity. That's the best part. Hire what you can't do or don't know how to do. Yeah. Or I don't want to get up on a roof two stories up. But this house dates back to 1917. Anyway,
wow.
This little town of 500 put on one heck of a parade Saturday morning or Saturday midday. And it was it was a big parade for a small town.
That's summertime in small town America, right?
And then fireworks. You know, it really is that everybody we've met there in the last almost a year now has been completely small town, don't like the big cities, and they're friendly as all get out.
You bet. All right. Great neighborhood connectedness there. Now, one of the stories you were telling me about off the air is another increase in taxpayer programs for illegal aliens.
Yeah, I mean, because the attorneys general of Oregon and Washington have signed on to a letter from Letitia James, the highly political AG of New York. And what they've said is they're objecting to the idea that Donald Trump, call me crazy, but I agree with him, does not want to pay for benefits for illegal aliens. And I would bet if you could put that to a vote that the Supreme Court of Washington State would not throw out, if you ask most people, should illegal aliens have access, say, to Medicaid? Taxpayer-funded health insurance. It's not free. It's taxpayer-funded. And right now, under Biden, they were allowing illegal aliens to sign up for it. And this is costing us hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. And Trump has said that comes to an end. You need to either be here legally, green card, or citizen. Otherwise, you can't have it. Washington and Oregon have both signed on to a letter demanding that this change. Well, I don't think they're going to get anything, but for political purposes, they're advocating to have taxpayers fund benefits to illegal aliens.
Yeah.
Does your audience support that?
Oh, I doubt they would. And, you know, this is all coming at the same time that the big, beautiful bill is trying to reduce that expenditure by reforming Medicaid, aid to the states. And who's the biggest complainer about it? The Democrats. So.
Yeah, because they want to support deadbeats. And by deadbeats, the other category that gets cut beyond illegals is able-bodied, childless, working-age adults. Not children, not retirement age, not disabled, don't have a kid, just want to sit and play video games all day long and sit on the couch and still get benefits. Who in your audience would vote for that?
Yeah, that makes no sense. That's kind of continuing the Democratic Party enabling of people's behavior.
Drug
addiction and the homelessness, and this is kind of what the Democratic Party brand has become. Let's enable people for negative behavior.
You know, I've got an easier idea, though, is to keep the Democrats from using up their food stamps. Do you know where you hide them?
Oh, okay.
Under their work boots.
Okay, keep them in there, give them a reason to.
If you put them under their work boots, they're never going to find their food stamps.
All right, Lars Larson, thank you for that one. Zinger as we roll out here. You hear Lars noon to 3 here on Talk Radio 570 KVI every weekday. A guest that's coming on to join me about a lawsuit against Seattle over the city of Seattle's mandatory housing affordability program. But 1 hour from now, we'll give you the first contest keyword and our chance to win a trip to Iceland. It's KVI's Take the Trip or Keep the Cash contest. This week's trip is Iceland. Last week, the trip was Maui, and our winner came from Puyallup. Nancy in Puyallup ended up winning last week's trip. You could win this week's trip to Iceland or keep the $3,000 cash. It's your choice. And KVI's Take the Trip or Keep the Cash contest. We'll give you that contest keyword to start off the next hour here on the Morning Ride. Let me welcome into the program attorney with Institute for Justice. Saranjan Sen joins me here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. And Saranjan, thanks for coming on to talk to me about this lawsuit on behalf of a couple of property owners that you are representing in Seattle.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so this all revolves around the City of Seattle's mandatory housing affordability program. And you have a couple of property owners that were trying to follow along this mandatory housing affordability law in Seattle. And it turns out that it was incredibly costly. And now the lawsuit that you're filing on behalf of your clients is saying that the whole city law unconstitutionally penalizes property owners for trying to build more housing and increase housing supply. Does that summarize it generally?
I think that's a pretty good summary by and large. That's right. That what's basically happening is that the city is taking advantage of the land use permitting process as an opportunity to extort money or property from owners rather than an opportunity to exercise impact mitigation, which is what the land use permitting process is supposed to be about.
Mitigation. And that basically comes back to, hey, you want to do X, Y, and Z improvements. You have to do X, Y, and Z criteria to make it nice enough to essentially meet the code, or in this case, the mandatory housing affordability law.
That's right. So in classical constitutional terms, the city can put conditions on your ability to build on your property that would mitigate and that would not be excessive to, or I'm sorry, that would represent and not be excessive to the public harms from your project. So let me give you a typical example.
Yeah.
That if you want to build on a flood drainage area and it's going to have the likely result of causing flooding downstream to other people's property, the city can tell you, look, we're not going to let you have a permit to build unless you pay us money to create new flood drainage area to make up for that loss of that flood drainage that you're going to be building on.
Possibly offset that calamity, right?
That's right. But the two things that the city can't do is they're not allowed to use the opportunity to charge you for something that has nothing to do with your project. So if they were to say, okay, we're not going to give you a build permit for your own property unless you first pay to renovate City Hall. You know, like what does that have to do with anything?
Yeah. What does A have to do with
B? And then secondly, it's supposed to be tailored in amount. So we're not going to let you build on your property unless you pay for new flood drainage for the entire city. And so what's going on here is that several years ago, the city quite rightly recognized that there is a massive housing shortage in Seattle. And unfortunately, I don't think any of your listeners hearing this is going to find that remotely surprising.
Exactly, right?
And that there's not enough housing. And you know, housing is not somehow immune from the laws of supply and demand. You don't have enough of it, the price is going to skyrocket, and we've seen that. And so the city quite rightly realized we need to allow there to be more homes built. In much of the city, it was literally illegal to build more homes on the lots, not for any kind of reason of safety, not for any kind of reason of public order, but just because of these arbitrary limitations where we've decided that you've reached the maximum number of homes that can be built on your property that with no real basis in anything. And so the city recognized several years ago, we need to change this. We have a massive housing shortage, and this is causing extremely high rents. It's causing extremely high cost to buy, and it's the end result is that ordinary folks, middle class folks, pretty much everybody who is not either independently wealthy or qualifies for government housing cannot afford to live in Seattle. And once again, unfortunately, I don't think your listeners are going to find this surprising.
Well, let's go through a little bit of what is happening with your clients and why this led to a lawsuit against the city of Seattle. You're representing a married couple in Seattle. They wanted to develop a single family home into a smaller duplex and then an accessory dwelling unit. ADU is kind of the real estate acronym there. And then they contacted a local builder that wanted to construct 4 townhomes on his property. So are these the two separate clients that you've got here, or cases that you've got?
That's right. They're two different clients we have here. We have one client who wished to remodel their house in a way that would added, like you said, effectively an accessory dwelling unit. And then the second client is a small-time local developer who wanted to build, is in the process right now of building a four-unit townhouse development. And so what the city did is when they went to apply for a building permit, they were both given a bill for these massive low-income housing fees, or MHA fees, mm-hmm. what you call the mandatory housing affordability fees, mm-hmm. in addition to their regular permitting fees, which represent the city's attempt at taking this, because they want to build on their home, as an opportunity to obtain low-income housing subsidies from them.
And to the tune of $36,000 for the married couple's case, and then $126,000 in fees for the guy who wanted to construct the four townhomes on his property.
Yeah, that's correct. But what these fees represent is they don't represent any kind of impact of what these people, these property owners are harming onto the public fisc, because the point is that as the city recognizes, when you're adding units to the city, you're adding housing to the city, you're actually helping make houses more affordable for people, yeah. including low-income people. And so just if I may back up for a moment, the genesis of this program was several years ago, the city recognized that there needs to be more housing in Seattle, and so they upzoned areas of the city, saying that you can build more densely, you can build more tall, you can build like maybe a townhouse development in what was previously a single-family zone. But at the same time, the city instituted this MHA program, which says, but it's going to cost you. And so now in Seattle, in zones across all of Seattle that have been upzoned within the last few years, if you wish to add any kind of housing unit to the city, a permit is going to cost you a per square foot fee in low-income housing subsidies. So on the one hand, the city is saying we desperately need more housing for the purposes of making housing more affordable. And then on the other hand, the city is saying, but if you wish to add more housing, it's going to cost you.
Now, Saranjan, one of the elements of this Seattle law that's called the Mandatory Housing Affordability Program would mm-hmm. require your clients to make two of their new units rent-restricted for affordable housing. So can you explain what that rent-restricted affordable housing element involves?
Absolutely. So when I was saying earlier about that you have to pay low-income housing subsidies, technically the city gives you a choice. Either you can pay a fee that the city will then use to construct and operate government housing, or you can agree to build a certain number of units and then operate them yourself as low-income public housing for 75 years. Those could be units that are either within your development or you might have to build elsewhere. So, for example, for the Tishomes, the couple who wish to remodel their home, they would have had to have, if they wished not to pay the fee, they would have had to provide two units and operate them as affordable housing for 75 years. Well, they can't do that while still having the use of their home. So they would have had to build off-site and provide it. Those kinds of requirements are extremely expensive. And so unsurprisingly, I believe based on the city's own numbers, some 95% of developers in the city have been opting to pay the in-lieu fee, performance option where you directly provide and operate low-income housing units for 75 years.
Wow. Okay. And
go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, one of the other items that seems to crop up for this Seattle law, I was wondering, can you address how the description tightened building codes and ballooning construction costs have impacted your clients? Because those are kind of separate and distinct. We know about construction costs or materials and things like that that are causing increases in the prices of housing and developing new housing. But how does tighten building codes? Is it just kind of part of the mandatory housing affordability program that Seattle set up?
Yeah, I think so. Like, Seattle is largely about the way that this works with. We're going this MHA program combines with the extreme cost of inflation over the last several years. So, as might not be all too surprising, when you start violating people's constitutional rights, that's bad enough. But it also often results in bad policy outcomes. You know, it turns out that not extorting people is good practice. And so the amount of these performance obligations, if you don't want to pay the fees, that applies to any given project, represents the city's assessment of the values of those upzoning. You remember how I said a moment ago that mm-hmm. in 2019, the city allowed people across the city to build more on their property. Well, the city assessed the market value of that, of the bill of the upzoning in 2019. And so what this program does, in a sense, is it makes property owners pay for the upzoning, whether they're utilizing it or not. Now, the problem with that, beyond how I explained how that's already unconstitutional, you can't charge someone for the right to build on their own land. Beyond that, it's that the market value of the upzoning, the city grossly overestimated it. So there was a report that came out in April a few months ago, and the mayor also addressed it in a letter to the people of Seattle, recognizing that, property rights aside, this program has been a policy failure. It is discouraging people from adding homes, adding housing in precisely the areas that the city has identified most need more housing. Mm-hmm. Because those are the areas that where the city said, oh, we're going to upzone these areas. And those are simultaneously the areas where the city then said, but you're going to have to, we're going to charge you a lot of money to build there. And so developers are avoiding those areas. They're increasingly avoiding building in Seattle altogether. And this program, even if you don't care about property rights, which of course I do, of course we all should, mm-hmm. This program has resulted in fewer homes being built and higher rents.
There you go. That whole effort to say, hey, we want to do this to create more housing affordability, although they say affordability when they mean subsidized housing in Seattle. And it's actually worked to discourage that rather than increase housing supply and new building that would increase housing supply. So I'm talking to an attorney with the Institute for Justice. His name's Saranjan Sen. He's representing a couple of clients in Seattle who were suing the city of Seattle over this ordinance that the city of Seattle has. Where does the legal process stand here? Are you going to try and negotiate with the city? Are you just going to go to trial and haggle it out in court? What's going to happen with that legal side of this?
So we anticipate that the city is – so there's already right now – this is our second challenge against this program. Our first challenge was representing a property owner who had not paid the fee but who was seeking an order telling Seattle that they may not require her to pay the fee in the future. And so relating to that, the trial court had on procedural grounds ruled that you basically have to – in so many words, you have to pay the fee first and then you have to challenge it. So that's on appeal, and we're confident we're optimistic on that case's on that case's chances. But we filed this new case just because you never know how these procedural things. It'll take years, and meanwhile, the city is still every single day extorting property owners and making it more difficult for ordinary folks to live in Seattle. We filed this new case in the meantime. There's a chance that this court is going to stay this case while that first case is on appeal to see how that goes. Okay. But even if it goes forward right now, what we anticipate is that the city is going to file what's called a motion to dismiss, which says, look, even if all the facts you allege are correct, you're wrong in the law, so you lose. And we welcome that fight because we want to get straight to the heart of the law that, you know, at bottom, cities should not be able to take advantage of people just because they happen to need a permit to fill their homes. These people, they pay their property taxes. And what are taxes for? This is not against the concept of subsidizing low-income housing. This is against obtaining those subsidies in this manner.
Okay. The hoops basically that a property owner has to jump through if they want to upzone their own land, right?
That's what they wish to just use. Well, the land's already been upzoned, and then what this does is it charges you if you want to build anything within that sure. land that's been upzoned, whether utilizing the upzoning or not. But the bottom line is we're hoping to do whatever it takes to streamline this to go as fast as possible, because yes, this is about these particular property owners getting their money back or being able to move forward with their projects. But even more broadly, this is about ending an unconstitutional program that is resulting in housing being more expensive for Seattleites everywhere.
There you go. Not solving the problem it said it was intending to solve. Saranjan Sen, an attorney with the Institute for Justice and representing a combination of Seattle property owners that are taking the city to court over the mandatory housing affordability program or ordinance in the city of Seattle. Saranjan, thank you very much for taking time to talk to us. We'll keep our ear to the ground, and we want to see how this case plays out in court, and wish you and your clients success on this so that maybe we can get something that actually does work on the books in Seattle.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
All right. We'll talk soon. Thank you for your time today. Wow. I knew that we talk about dysfunctional politics and the cost of living and affordability problems in the Seattle area. This one specific to Seattle. Wow. That really sheds a lot of light on why property owners aren't taking advantage of what Seattle wanted to set up when it comes to trying to upzone and provide more housing density.
Talk about robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, it comes back to that too. It's time to play our quiz game against my producer, Zach Wildfang. We call this quiz 3 Under 30, and we do this because Zach was born in the year 2000. We thought, hey, let's challenge Zach and the KVI listeners with trivia from before Zach was born and see who is the trivia expert. And our contestant for this morning on 3 Under 30 is Mason in Enumclaw. Hi, Mason. Good morning. Thanks for calling in to play.
Good morning to you.
All right. Great to have you here. We were just out in Enumclaw for the King County Fair. Did you make it to the fair, or is that something that
I
just...
I did go.
Yeah, right on. That's cool to hear. That's great. Okay, Mason, thank you. The category is pop culture, so I'm going to give you 30 seconds. We're going to give you three questions, and then we're going to compare how you do to Zach, and if you tie or beat Zach, you're going to win the $50 Daniel's Broiler gift card and the two tickets to the screening of the new movie, Naked Gun, the remake starring Liam Neeson instead of Leslie Nielsen. All right, you ready to play?
I'm ready to compete.
Let's go. 30 seconds. Pop culture. Which event occurred first, the NASA moon landing or the Woodstock concert?
Woodstock.
Okay, incorrect. Name an actress that starred in TV's Charlie's Angels.
Farrah Fawcett.
That is correct. Who's known as America's oldest teenager?
America's oldest teenager.
There used to be a show called American Bandstand was part of it.
Dick Clark.
Oh, just at the wire. Excellent. Mason, nicely done. Let's bring in Zach now. Zach will have the same three questions. Stay on the line with me, Mason, and we'll give Zach the same pop culture questions. We'll see how things go. And if you're going to win the tickets and the $50 Daniel's Broiler gift card to join us at the screening of the Naked Gun movie. Zach, pop culture, 30 seconds.
Right.
Here we go. Which event occurred first, the NASA moon landing or Woodstock? The Woodstock concert.
Woodstock?
Incorrect. Name an actress that starred on
moon
the
landing
TV
was
show.
July 19, 1969. I know that.
We did just go past the anniversary. Name an actress that starred in TV's Charlie's Angels.
Pass.
Okay. Who's known as America's oldest teenager? Revolved around a show called American Bandstand. There's your hint.
Dick Clark?
Dick Clark is correct. Okay. Well, Mason, congratulations. You got two. Zach got one. Farrah Fawcett wins the contest for Mason in Enumclaw.
I've never seen an episode. I've never seen a remake.
But
I know how to do the little finger gun pose.
Exactly. You know all of that. So the moon landing did occur before the Woodstock concert. Woodstock was in August of 1969. And, of course, we just went past the moon landing anniversary, the lunar landing here on Sunday for July 20th. Charlie's Angels.
20th?
Yes.
Okay.
Charlie's Angels. Farrah Fawcett. Kate Jackson, Jacqueline Smith, Cheryl Ladd, and then you had the substitutes that took over when their other characters got moved along. Shelley Hack, Tanya Roberts.
If you say so.
Would have been acceptable answers. And then Dick Clark, America's oldest teenager. Congratulations, Mason. Are you going to be able to make it to the movie screening and see the Naked Gun with Ari, Mike, and Zach. I'm going to be on vacation. I'm not going to be able to make it, but you're going to be able to make it into Seattle for that?
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. We love to hear that. Mason, thank you for playing 3 Under 30. We appreciate you being on. You're going to win the $50 Daniel's Broiler gift card. And then Naked Gun will come out for all audiences a week from this Friday. Isn't it a week from this Friday? Yeah, yep, Friday the 1st. Yep. Friday, August 1st. Okay. Great round of 3 Under 30. Good questions, good answers, good trivia. All right. In Tukwila, you had the murder of a 67-year-old woman in the parking lot of a Costco. And I want to say this happened about a year ago. The murder suspect has been on the run and fled Seattle 4 days after the killing, prosecutors alleged, and fled to Kenya, flew to Kenya, but has now been brought back to Seattle. Como 4 reporter Jeremy Harris has covered this story. And here is the update about how this murder investigation went from the Tukwila Costco parking lot all the way to Kenya.
The accused shooter, Salman Haji, fled the country 5 days after the murder. Well, we now know the FBI went to Kenya, apprehended him, and he is now here at the King County Jail. We're also going to show you new exclusive videos from the investigation as the case moves forward. Investigators say this is Salman Haji in the red. This video from a grocery store surveillance camera showing him and co-defendant Ilyas Abdi as they buy gift cards with a credit card of a woman who they are accused of carjacking in Seattle on the morning of January 26, 2024.
So the story that Jeremy Harris is describing, they've got video from the grocery store. And if you've been at the self-check register at the grocery store, you know that there's video that's taken right up above your head.
A little too much video.
Sometimes, right? And this is a key component in this story. In just about every step of this crime spree, these two suspects are on recorded security cam video. So we'll continue with that here in just a moment. That was some of the opening of the story. And then this is kind of the next step in what happened. Oh, this is the description of what happened in the Costco parking lot in Tukwila. So that's the next part of the story that Jeremy Harris is going to explain.
20 minutes after this video was taken, another camera is rolling in the parking lot of the Costco in Tukwila. Here, investigators say Abdi is driving and Haji is in the passenger seat with a gun. And here, 67-year-old Yuan Ming and her sister are walking back to their car. You see the stolen Porsche SUV drive past them, then flip around. And it's here where investigators say Haji gets out of the car and tries to steal a purse from Ming's sister, who's in the driver's seat. It's tough to see, but Ming is in the passenger seat and reaches over to help her sister as she struggles with Haji.
And he says it's tough to see. It's pretty clear to see what's going on. The trick being that you're looking at the front-facing windshield of the car that the two victims are in, and that's what kind of obscures what's directly going on in the front and the driver's seat and the passenger seat in the front part of this vehicle. So it's otherwise, it's very clear to see what is going on this parking lot security cam video at the Costco Tukwila.
Police say Haji shoots Ming in the chest, then runs back to the car and Abdi speeds off. The car was found abandoned hours later. Police say a social media post tipped Haji off that he'd been identified as a suspect in the murder, and he fled the country on a flight from SeaTac 4 days later.
4 days after the alleged murder, and he is eastbound and down to Kenya. Now, here's the role of the second suspect in this murder of a 67-year-old woman in the Tukwila Costco parking lot.
After Haji left the country, Abdi was arrested months later for an unrelated shooting and then charged with Ming's murder. Haji was on the run for over a year until federal prosecutors say the FBI tracked him down in Kenya and brought him back to Seattle to face charges for the Costco murder. Haji is now being held on a bail of $5 million here at the jail. I've checked in with the courts. It's not clear when he's going to have an appearance in front of a judge. The other suspect, Ilyas Abdi, he's pleaded not guilty to the charges. And as you heard in that report, he is charged with two separate shootings. So he's being held on a bail of $6 million.
So $10 million and $6 million, something like that, for bail. And both of these suspects, one that fled to Kenya, is 20 years old. And I have to wonder, why do people keep committing crimes? It's all captured. Almost always it's captured on security cam video. Like I said, virtually every step in this murderous crime spree with these two suspects, they're all clearly captured on security camera video. And what does a one-way flight to Kenya cost? Is that got to be a grand? Maybe a little bit more?
Oh, at least.
Something? Was that ticket purchased with stolen money or proceeds from other thefts? I hope that that question would get answered. Otherwise, are we talking about how many people were involved with helping this 20-year-old murder suspect flee the country? And are those people going to be prosecuted? And then there's the probably the biggest issue of all. You've got a 20-year-old murder suspect now, allegedly with a handgun, illegal possession of a firearm. And yet, I haven't heard any Democrats complaining about the murder of a woman of color in broad daylight in a store parking lot. This woman's 67 years old. She's shopping with her sister. They're in the front seat of their car. They're trying to leave. And these two stolen car suspects try and rob them of a purse, and they park their stolen vehicle, this stolen vehicle, behind the women's car in the parking lot, in the parking stall at the Costco, to prevent them from pulling out and then try and steal away the purse from the front seat. And for some reason, 67-year-old Yuan Ming ends up getting shot and dies all over a purse snatching in a Puget Sound parking lot. You know, I talk about this constantly, the lack of public safety around Seattle and all of the political activism that has led to the lawlessness and the lack of public safety around Seattle. It's a war on women. Yuan Ming, she was murdered over a purse in Tukwila. And there's not a peep going on about how we have another case where there's going to be a 20-year-old on trial for having a gun and being put on trial for murder. But we don't have seem to have any Democrats in elected positions in the state of Washington. Bob Ferguson, silent. Nick Brown, silent. The attorney general of our state is Nick Brown, silent about how people under the age of 21 are getting their hands illegally on firearms. And now you wonder why we need change in the political direction of the state. This is rinse, wash, repeat. And unfortunately, the people that are paying the highest price are 67-year-old Yuan Ming, her sister, and the rest of the Ming family. Congratulations, Democrats. Congratulations. The morning ride here, Talk Radio 570 KVI, got to be candid, got to be blunt. It's got to be said. That's why I wanted to present this story for you here on the show this morning. Somebody else who was candid and blunt, but I don't know if he's going to have the same impact. Hunter Biden. We'll get into the Hunter Biden interview clips. And Zach, who was interviewing Hunter Biden? Was he more of a...
It's a YouTuber. I think it's called Channel 5 News, okay. But it's not a channel. It's not in any way associated with King or anything like that.
I was looking at the images of the guy who was doing the interviewing, and I was kind of wondering, okay, is this a social media influencer or social media podcast type host, video host? And the guy doing the interviewing, he looks like an ectomorph version of Jonah Hill.
Yeah, he does.
So, yeah. So let's go explore what Hunter Biden just had to say, because I think he fancies himself maybe a future political campaign manager based on what he said and this F-bomb laden rant that he went on this social media host's channel on YouTube. That's what we'll get into. We'll tell you how this ties into what former President Biden said about Hunter Biden being the smartest guy in the room. So we'll hit all of that coming up next here on The Morning Ride. Hunter Biden didn't seem to change too many minds about his disposition. That was for sure when he went on, social media personalities interview of a guy named Andrew Callahan, a YouTube channel Zach was talking about here in the last segment. My producer, Zach Wildfang. This is The Morning Ride, everybody. But let's get into Hunter Biden's F-bomb laden interview with Andrew Callahan. And here's a part where Hunter Biden started talking about immigration deportation issues with the Trump administration.
White men in America are 45 more times likely to commit a violent crime than an immigrant. And the media says, well, you got David Axelrod and, you know, Rahm Emanuel. So smart Rahm Emanuel. And said, we got to understand that these people are really mad.
And those two names Hunter Biden mentions are Democratic campaign strategist types.
And we got to appeal to these white voters. Rahm, the only people that appealed to those white voters was Joe Biden, 81 years old, and he got 81 million votes. And he did not because he appeased their Trumpian sense, but because he challenged it. And he said, you can be an 81-year-old Catholic from Scranton that doesn't understand it, but still has empathy for transgender people and immigrants. Then nobody said, oh, Joe Biden's going to turn us into a socialist state, no matter how much they said it. But these guys think that we need to run away from all values in order for us to lead. I say, you. How are we getting those people back from El Salvador? Because I'll tell you what, if I became president in 2 years from now, or 4 years from now, or 3 years from now, I would pick up the phone and call the president of El Salvador and say, you either send them back or I'm going to invade. It's a crime what they're doing. He's a dictator thug.
Bukele or Trump?
Both.
I don't know why I don't know why Hunter Biden isn't a campaign manager if he's got all these perfect ideas for what the American public wants.
I was thinking speechwriter.
Yeah, speechwriter would fit the bill as well. So, Hunter Biden, is he still on cocaine? Is that what's happening as he makes all these comments? Thank you very much, Rick James. There we go. Now, here's Hunter Biden talking about how his dad, a year ago yesterday, had that failed debate against Trump that prompted him to withdraw from the presidential campaign last year.
I know exactly what happened in that debate. He flew around the world, basically, the mileage that he could have flown around the world 3 times.
Yeah.
He's 81 years old. He's tired as give him Ambien to be able to sleep. He gets up on the stage, and he looks like he's a deer in the headlights.
So why didn't you suggest something different, Hunter? He seems to be inferring that anybody inside the Biden White House had more control over Biden than certainly he did as his son.
I mean, he's talking about his dad as if Joe Biden was a zoo animal or a circus animal.
Okay, all right.
Parade him around, give him the drugs, wheel him out there, put on the show.
Yeah, put him up on stage and then pull him off the stage. And then this is Hunter Biden talking about the difference between powder cocaine and crack
cocaine.
This
is unrelated. It's my special request, and I'm very fond of this clip.
Let's listen to that moment.
Do you know what I mean?
Well, because they think cocaine, Scarface, very cool. Yeah. Crack cocaine, they think The Wire.
Oh, in that sense? Oh, absolutely.
You know what I mean? They don't know how similar the chemical compounds are.
Well, the only difference between crack cocaine and cocaine is sodium bicarbonate and water and heat, literally.
That's it?
That's it.
And those things are pretty much free if you go to, like, a science store.
This is free. You can go to a your neighborhood convenience store and just get... Anyway, I don't want to tell people how to make crack cocaine, but it literally is a managed jar of cocaine and baking soda.
How different is the experience?
It's vastly, vastly different. And, like, for real, I feel really reluctant to kind of have some euphoric discussion. I know you're not asking me to do that, but have some euphoric discussion about crack cocaine.
I think this might be kind of the opposite here.
Okay, no, it's the exact opposite. I'm saying I don't want to have the experience of some euphoric recall. That's how powerful crack cocaine is. Does crack cocaine make you act any differently? No. Is it safer than alcohol? Probably. People think of crack as being dirty. It's the exact opposite. When you make crack, what you're doing is you're burning off all the impurities so that it combines with the sodium bicarbonate, which makes it smokable.
This is like an This is like an episode of Breaking Bad.
I tell you,
Hunter Biden.
You know, an interview like a sober man would do.
Yeah. All right. And let's see if we can plug in this. Let's tie all this together. Hunter Biden. We had the Stephen Colbert getting canceled by CBS. We have Joe Biden's status in all of this. Let's roll back to a couple years ago when Stephen Colbert was interviewing Joe Biden. And Joe Biden said, Hunter Biden was the smartest man I know.
You know that the people who want to make hay in Washington are going to try to use your adult son as a cudgel against you. How do you feel about that? And what do you have to say to those people?
Well, look, we have great confidence in our son. I am not concerned about any accusations been made against him. It's used to get to me. I think it's kind of foul play. But look, it is what it is. And he's a grown man. He is the smartest man I know. I mean, in sort of pure intellectual capacity. And as long as he's good, we're good.
All right. Smartest man I know, says Joe Biden. That's three quarters of a Democratic Mount Rushmore right there. Stephen Colbert. Hunter Biden, Joe Biden. The Democrats just have to come up with a fourth for their little Mount Rushmore of 21st century politics. We're taking conservatives to work and liberal progressive Democrats to task for their dysfunctional politics because you know what we want to do? We want to make Washington livable again. It's not too much to ask. I promise you it's not too much. Hello, everybody. I'm your host, Phil Vandervoort. Great to have you with on Tuesday. And my producer, Zach Wildfang, is here as well. Hello, Zach.
Morning, Phil.
All right. Cruising right along here on the morning ride on a kind of cloudy start to the day. And let's get you a contest keyword so that you can enter to win KVI's Take the Trip or Keep the Cash contest. This week's trip, Iceland, the island nation of Iceland. You've got the geothermal stuff, the hot springs, the waterfalls, the volcanoes.
Not to be confused with future American territory, Greenland.
True. Next door neighbor to Greenland, but not to be confused with. So, and this is the other thing I've always heard about the name Iceland, the name Greenland, that they probably should have been switched. They should have called the tiny island of Iceland Greenland because it is much more verdant and green. And then right now, Greenland is quite icy and frost covered. So, slight distinction there, just a little oddity, but Iceland is the location of this week's trip, or you can keep the $3,000 cash, all the natural wonders that there are to see and do in Iceland. This would be, you know, back to what we talked about with one of the first trips that we did to Venice. You know, we're talking once-in-a-lifetime bucket list type trip here. So you could win the trip to Iceland. We want to get you registered to win. Here's how you get registered to win the contest this week. Text the word GLOW, G-L-O-W. The sun is a glow in summertime. GLOW, G-L-O-W. I guess just leave off the A that I was just trying to reference there. Big mistake on my part. GLOW, moonlight glow. How about that? GLOW, G-L-O-W. Spell it correctly. Text that to 206-421-5757. You don't have to add anything else. Just the four letters to spell GLOW, G-L-O-W. Text that before 9 o'clock to 206-421-5757. That gets you entered to win the big trip or the $3,000 this week on KVI's Take the Trip or Keep the Cash contest. And then just for entering today, you're going to be in a drawing with KVI listeners to win a $50 Daniel's Broiler gift card. So two chances to win with one entry this hour. Text the keyword GLOW, G-L-O-W. We'll give you more contest keywords at 11:04, at 1:04, just as the second hour of the Lars Larson show starts at 1:04. And then with Ari Hoffman, our afternoon host, at 4:02, you'll get a fourth contest keyword. That gives you four chances to enter today. The more chances you enter, the more chances you have to win. KVI's Take the Trip or Keep the Cash contest. We're going for a couple more weeks here, kind of our summer-long contest, and we want to make you a winner here on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Thanks for playing the KVI Take the Trip or Keep the Cash contest. So at the bottom of the hour, I'll bring on my next guest, State Representative from Spokane, Republican State Representative Jenny Graham. She has been following some events related to the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board. This is the panel in the state of Washington that's appointed by the governor. They look at convicted violent criminals and whether or not those convicted violent criminals are going to get a chance to get out on parole or probation early from their sentence. And there is a very well-known case out of Spokane in the late 1970s involving a serial killer known as the Hillside Strangler, a guy that has changed his name now. He was convicted as Kenneth Bianchi, but he has since changed his name in prison, and he is applying to get out of prison early. The Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board will handle that review, and I want to bring attention to this. My guest, State Representative from Spokane, Jenny Graham, she wants to bring attention to this because this is not a person that needs to be released early from life in prison conviction and sentence dating back to the murder of young women. And some of them, a couple of them, were students, Western Washington University students. So that is what we'll do coming up at 8:35 here as we try and keep the state accountable to enforcing these jury and courtroom verdicts on convicted killers in the state of Washington. Coming up next week, pardon me, coming up in 2 weeks, it's 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today, you've got your August 5th primary vote across the state of Washington. So ballots have been sent out. They're probably at your house, your apartment, wherever you're living. And make sure that you get that primary vote in on or before August 5th, 2 weeks from today. In King County, there is a countywide property tax levy for parks and continuing a parks levy. And the parks levy would go to fund things. This is almost like the NPR PBS funding that was clawed back by the rescissions in the United States Congress and has now been enacted by Donald Trump. In King County, we all pay property tax to make the Woodland Park Zoo run and the Seattle Aquarium run and operate and the new downtown waterfront park. And I don't understand if these things are popular enough, why are we subsidizing them? If these are popular enough attractions, and when you think about the Woodland Park Zoo, I don't know how many KVI listeners come from outside Seattle to go to Woodland Park Zoo. But Woodland Park Zoo is sitting on some of the more valuable property the city of Seattle has to offer. And if a zoo is a big enough attraction, you know, does it need to take up land in a city where housing supply is already too short and there needs to be more housing supply? So that's one question. And then the Seattle Aquarium, very prime piece of property down on the Seattle waterfront. If these are two attractions, two places that tourists want to go, families want to take their kids, and all those kind of school excursions, field trips, and things like that, these things should be able to pay for themselves on their own. They certainly don't need property tax support. And we've talked about this with Mariners stadiums and Seahawks stadiums, and if it's hockey or NBA or Sounders or soccer or what have you. If these are popular enough sports that people want to go and watch, they should be paid for by either the team owners and or the fans. And there has been a bit of a shift where the taxes have gone way up on ticket prices and parking and concessions and stuff like that. And that does cover some of it. But far too often, like the aquarium, like a zoo, there is public support for some of these pro sports teams. And if they are good enough to stand on their own, they shouldn't need public taxpayer support. So this is something that's up for vote on the August 5th primary ballot in King County. parks levy renewal. And I got a email from a listener, Don in Kent. And Don was looking over this King County parks levy that's on the ballot. King County voters are going to have to decide on this. And Don writes, "Hey, Phil, I looked up on the King County Republican Party website from the interview you had last week, and they put out all of their voters' guide recommendations on the King County Republican Party website for the August 5th primary. And Don writes, after listening to your interview with the King County Republican Party chair, Jolie Lansdowne, I was very surprised to see the King County Republicans did not have a recommendation on King County Proposition 1, which is the parks levy. This proposition is on the primary ballot, but there is no runoff here. It's purposefully tucked away on the ballot for a midsummer vote. However, this Prop 1 is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Property values from 2026 form a baseline for a guaranteed future increase for the life of the levy, regardless of what may occur to an individual property value. For example, if a home with assessed value of $800,000 went down to $600,000 in a housing market downturn, overall property taxes may go down, but the amount of the Prop 1 levy would still go up depending on which increase calculation that King County uses. The cost to the property owner will always go up, and it cannot go down. I would like to see the King County Republican Party address this Proposition 1. So if you have Jolie Lansdowne on again, the chair of the King County Republican Party, ask her about this. And that is why I would simply say this is why you need to vote no on this King County property tax levy, continuation of an existing levy that goes to support parks. And, you know, one of the other things is, how many parks do we have to chase homeless people out of that are squatting inside King County parks? I know this is very prevalent in Seattle, and King County has been, Seattle specifically has been a little bit more proactive about sweeping them out of parks rather than just let them congregate in parks the way it was a couple of years ago. I would love any input KVI listeners have right now on the text line, 206-421-5757, 206-421-5757. And if you've got any examples of homeless people you've seen congregating in King County parks, big distinction between city stuff, you know, whether it's City of Bellevue, City of North Bend, City of Sammamish, City of, Kent or Renton, Enumclaw, versus King County parks. If you've got any examples of that, would love to see that. I don't know how prevalent a problem that is, but I think, and I kind of use this example on other tax hike proposals, always vote no. Vote no on the property tax hike proposals, a sales tax hike proposal, any of that. Vote no. And force the people who are advocating for the tax hike to come back with a smaller, maybe more realistic, and more targeted tax hike, and then decide on the merits, but never accept the first offer in a negotiation, right? So that's a good reason for all King County voters to vote no on renewing this property tax levy. And let Woodland Park Zoo, let Seattle Aquarium, let them stand on their own feet. And if they are as popular as they seem to be, people will come out and pay to go through there. Charities and donors, if they really want the zoo and the aquarium, they can fundraise to benefit those two facilities. But taxpayer-funded support for them, if they're as good as they say they are and as popular as they feel they are, then those types of facilities, attractions, they can cover their costs on their own. They don't need public support. Do this through charity. That's what charity is for, if that's what it's ultimately going to take. So that's a great reminder from Don in Kent. Thank you for the email. And Vote no. Vote no on that property tax extension for King County Parks. And then come back in the on the next election, you know, next February or something like that. And put up another property tax hike that's more narrow, costs everybody less, and makes Washington, particularly Western Washington or King County specifically, more affordable. That's what it would end up doing if you vote no on this property tax hike, King County Parks levy on the August 5th primary ballot. Property taxes, how that impacts cost of living for all of us here in Western Washington. And I was kind of directly talking about King County in the last segment. This is The Morning Ride here. I'm your host, Phil Vandervoort. Got a caller about this. Former King County Council member Kathy Lambert calling in to The Morning Ride. Hello, Kathy. Thank you for calling into the show. You heard what I was talking about with this property tax levy extension on the August 5th primary ballot, right?
Absolutely. And you're doing a great job. It's so fun to hear your voice.
Thank you.
So, yes, I totally agree with what you're saying. And one of the other points in this is that it says that the escalation, the increase, will be based on RCW, Revised Code of Washington, 84.55.
Okay.
So I thought, well, that will be interesting. Let me look that up. It has 9 subsections. So you got to figure out which subsection it would be under, which for the average person would be like, what the heck is this? And then, you know, try to guess from there. So I think that that is a scam, and I think that Nick Brown, our AG, should intervene to say you can't do that. You can't force people who are not used to reading the RCWs because they've become very complicated and just say, no, you can. You have to do that. Give us an idea. Under this subsection, whether it's subsection 1 or 5 or 8, and this is what the estimate would be, because otherwise you're just – committing to something and you have no idea what that is, and that is not fair to the taxpayers. So that's another game that was played in this RCW.
Well, didn't we have a judge that said the initiative that was voted on and approved last year by voters, Initiative 2066 on natural gas access, was too confusing for voters to decide on? Wasn't that the same
yes,
principle that was the judge ruled on that? But it's not too confusing when it comes to 9 subsections of the RCW when it comes to the property tax hike that's going to apply for the parks levy, right?
Exactly.
See how
and
that
your point
works?
Was yeah. very well taken yeah. on how Seattle-centric this is. And I've been spending a lot of time in my district. I have a lot more time now.
Mm-hmm.
And people are telling me it's just everything is Seattle-centric. And it is really sad because there's more to this county, as you know, than just Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
So but it's really important.
Not according to the elected officials in this in the county of King, though. Not according to them. Kathy, thank you very much for checking in. Thanks for calling the show and adding that perspective about how complex
absolutely.
This gets and how the, you know, it's kind of like the fox watching the hen house, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
All right.
So thank you for presenting this to everybody so that they know what kinds of tricks are being put out. And that's not okay.
Yep.
Transparency is important.
Like we talk about, dysfunctional politics. And Kathy just hit on something that's important for all of us, whether you're in King County or not in King County, one of the other counties, part of Western Washington, or, you know, even if you're listening online where you are, for where you live and reside, that we've got this primary coming up 2 weeks from today. Rally your neighbors, rally your friends, rally your coworkers, rally your family, and make sure they understand what's at stake. And if they get confused on something like a parks property tax levy extension or whatever else ends up on the ballot, make sure that you can help them piece together what's going on. Because one thing or another, if they don't understand what's going on, they'll just leave it blank. And then that's one less vote that could have stopped a bad politician, a bad candidate, a bad levy proposal, a bad tax hike extension. So that's why it's important at this point, 2 weeks before a primary election, to make sure you're communicating with the people that are in your life. Like I said, people you're working with. See if they're tuned in to voting, and maybe you can be that spark that gets them to go, yeah, you know what? I don't want that to happen. I don't need that politician to get elected, one thing or another. I want to have somebody who's common sense in elected office, and maybe you can make that happen. The Morning Ride, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Phil Vandervoort, your show host here. And the state of Washington is in the midst of reviewing convicted criminals, violent criminals, that are petitioning for parole or probation in the state of Washington. It falls under the guise of a panel called the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board. That's basically the one who reviews these sorts of requests for probation or parole for violent offenders in the state of Washington. And there's a very well-known case out of Spokane that has connections across the state of Washington, somebody who is applying for this, that I think any logical thinking person would say, nah, this individual needs to stay behind bars and locked up. So we're going to talk about what's going on with the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board with Spokane State Representative, Republican Jenny Graham, joining me here on The Morning Ride. Hello, Representative Graham. Appreciate you coming on with me to talk about this.
Well, thank you for having me on your show today to talk about this important issue.
Yeah, people that have lived around Washington State long enough will certainly remember the name, the Hillside Strangler, or the phrase, the Hillside Strangler. I remember being a little kid, and not too long after the Ted Bundy case happened, this one was also in the news. And the guy that was convicted for this in the state of Washington was named Kenneth Bianchi in Spokane, known as the Hillside Strangler. And Kenneth Bianchi has changed his name in prison just a couple years ago, by the way, to Anthony D'Amato. So the name now that people need to be aware of is Anthony D'Amato, and he has petitioned the Washington State Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board for parole. And they heard some of this argument a month ago in June, and now they could be close to making a decision. What have you been able to discern from what's going on with this process, Representative Graham?
Well, so I got wind of this, and the first thing that I did was personally call the ISRB board to confirm, is this true or not? And they did confirm that they'd already had the hearing. From what I've been able to gather, they said that there would be a decision for whether he would be paroled, posted online by July 23rd. And I also called because I was trying to see if there was video that the general public could watch. Could they watch this hearing? And again, from what I've seen, it says that it's closed to the general public. Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to confirm that. They were supposed to get back with me and never did. But I do think that needs to be changed, because the public should have the right to, when these people are petitioning for release, they should have the right to know who this person is and see what's going on with the ISRB board. Oftentimes, this stuff happens in total secrecy and silence. This is an example of that, and I vehemently disagree with that. I think we need to be transparent when we're talking about these individuals possibly being released into our neighborhoods.
And then I hadn't realized that Kenneth Bianchi had changed his name, and it just happened a couple of years ago. Do you think that's a red flag for all of this effort to try and seek probation or parole with the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board?
I, again, disagree with that, especially when you're looking at the heinous crimes that this man committed, kidnapping children and young women, torturing them, raping them, murdering them. To me, and that's a trend that we're seeing in this state, that there is more effort placed in trying to protect their identities, which means if this person moves next door to you, you have no way of knowing who they are, and the danger for somebody that's capable of doing the things that this man did is extreme for them to redo it, especially when you look at the fact that nobody's held accountable when these people are let out and something goes sideways.
Yeah.
Every single time, without question, it is the crime victim and their family that are left holding the bag for any medical bills, any burial costs that may happen, any fallout. Maybe they can't return to work, so they lose their job, they lose their house, they maybe lose a marriage, lose friends and acquaintances because of the trauma. I mean, the list just goes on for the life sentence without parole that crime victims and their loved ones are given.
Yeah. And to let people know, this individual, formerly known as Kenneth Bianchi, convicted in 12 murders from 1977 in California to 1979 here in the state of Washington. And I want to list some of the names of these women that were killed, that Kenneth Bianchi, now Anthony D'Amato, changed his name a couple of years ago, was convicted of killing. 19-year-old Yolanda Washington, 15-year-old Judith Lynn Miller, 21-year-old Elisa Kasten, 28-year-old Evelyn Jane King, a 12-year-old Dolores Ann Cepeda, 14-year-old Sonia Johnson, 20-year-old Christina Weckler, 18-year-old Lauren Wagner, 17-year-old Kimberly Diane Martin, 20-year-old Cindy Hudspeth, 22-year-old Karen Mandick, and 27-year-old Diane Wilder. And the idea of letting anybody out who has killed 12 people is just a non-starter. And so what do you suggest people do at this point based on what the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board has been considering?
At this particular point in time, because their decision is expected by the 23rd of this month, it really would then fall on Governor Ferguson, because he can reject, if the ISRB board votes to give him parole, the governor can reject that. He has recently done that with Timothy Pauley, a mass murderer, and rightfully so. Once again, the people that are on this ISRB board, they're not accountable for, you know, anything that happens as a result of their decisions, which put our families in jeopardy. And, you know, I will also point out that Mr. Bianchi, in order to save his own pathetic life, took a plea deal for the death penalty to be off the table, and it was life without the possibility of parole in Washington State. It's consecutive sentencing, which is good, because they should have to serve for each one of the murders or crimes they've committed. California, which is where they're saying that he would go to serve life sentences there, theirs are concurrent. So they lump all of these things together. So he's serving time for basically the same amount of time for all of these other crimes, unfair.
Yeah, one crime, adding to another crime in the sentencing phase. I've got a phone number here, and I think this is what we want to encourage people to do, is contact Governor Bob Ferguson's office. And the phone number, I'll give it for Bob Ferguson here, but for all the listeners right now, when you have a moment, grab a pen and paper, pencil and paper, and we'll pass this along here for the remainder of the hour here on The Morning Ride. The phone number for Governor Ferguson's office, you want to call and tell him to block any possible probation or parole release of Anthony D'Amato, is the guy's current name, but formerly Kenneth Bianchi. And the phone number is 360-902-4111. So the 360 area code for Governor Ferguson's office, the phone number is 902-4111. And we will give you that phone number again a couple more times before we round out the hour. But that would be the best way for KVI listeners to make their impact known on the governor's office and make sure that Anthony D'Amato, a.k.a. Kenneth Bianchi, Hillside Strangler, remains locked up and does not get set free by the state review board on probation and parole. Is there anything else you want to add, Jenny?
Yes. The other thing I'd like to add is for your listeners to stay tuned. There's legislation that I am working on regarding truth in sentencing, because the bottom line is with these ISRB board hearings, it's the victims and their families that are pulled back in, you know, to have to deal with these hearings, which is so incredibly cruel for them. They don't get it. They have no attorney. The victim's advocate doesn't do much because they work for the ISRB board. So they, again, have to shelter all of the costs. And it's up to these crime victims' families to make the case for why this person shouldn't be released after the state already gave them a life without the possibility of parole sentence, which I did read was the case with Bianchi. Why it was switched to life, which in Washington state is about 13 and a half years, and they are eligible to apply through the Pardons and Clemency Board, the state board, at 7.5 years.
Yeah.
I think that when we look at these horrific crimes, these, if nothing else, there has to be truth in sentencing to protect our families, our loved ones, as a form of self-defense, you know, that these people are not allowed to roam in our communities to do this again and again and again.
Yeah. Now, Representative Graham, there's another case that you're starting to pick up on that happened in North Seattle, where we've got a 31-year-old woman named Kiara Sewell that was murdered. Kind of a boyfriend or a former boyfriend of hers is going to be charged with her murder. But the 31-year-old murder victim's mom is Tanika Tigner, and she is now trying to call on state lawmakers in the legislature in Olympia to get serious about not having somebody who had violent crimes in connection with the Blake decision, which was all about drug possession, getting out early, because that's what happened in the case of the man who's now going to be charged in the death of her, the murder of her daughter. So is this something that you can champion in the Washington legislature in Olympia?
Yeah, I did reach out to the mom. And again, your listeners may not be aware that this man already tried to stab his former girlfriend to death in her sleep. Mm-hmm. He had a 28-year sentence because of the Washington State Supreme Court legislating from the bench. This monster ended up getting 8 years of his sentence shaved off, and now he's gone on to murder her daughter. And the concern that I have, and this is again from 7 years of being on the Public Safety Committee, I'm now the ranking member for that committee, continuously, it is always about the criminal and them being portrayed as being the actual victim. It is absolutely true that in the state of Washington legislature, I have watched the silencing, censoring, and manipulation of these crime victims. You know, that's sometimes made me actually physically ill.
It does. Yeah.
It is so unfair. We are mandated under our constitution, state constitution, to treat the victims with the same amount of dignity and respect as the accused.
Representative Graham, yeah, we're running out of time. I will give everybody the information on Anthony D'Amato, a.k.a. Ken Bianchi, in the next segment. If you want to keep a serial killer in jail, that's what we're asking listeners to do this morning. I'll tell you how you can do that with a phone call to Governor Bob Ferguson's office. And Representative Graham, you and I will stay in touch, and we'll hope that either the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board does the right thing and denies it, or if necessary, we get Bob Ferguson to deny it. Jay Inslee kind of ended up doing some of this at the tail end of his tenure as governor. He ended up doing the right thing on the Timothy Pauley case. So we'll hope that Bob Ferguson might be able to do the same. But I want to thank you for your time and this difficult subject, coming on to talk with me about it. And hopefully we can make everybody accountable on this, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I will stay in contact and follow up with you as necessary. All right.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Representative Graham. Representative Jenny Graham, Republican State Representative from Spokane, here with me, Phil Vandervoort, on The Morning Ride. All right. Here on The Morning Ride, we're asking listeners to contact Governor Bob Ferguson's office to make sure that a convicted serial killer in the state of Washington stays in jail. He's asked for the Indeterminate Sentencing Review Board to review a case, possibly grant parole, probation. The guy that we want to keep in prison is Anthony D'Amato. Anthony, last name D'Amato, D apostrophe capital A-M-A-T-O, formerly Ken Bianchi. Formerly Ken Bianchi. He changed his name in 2023. But the suggestion from my guest in the last segment here on The Morning Ride is contact Governor Bob Ferguson's office. The phone number for Governor Bob Ferguson's office is 360-902-4111. Again, that's 360-902-4111. Contact Governor Ferguson's office and tell him, make sure that the convicted serial killer, Hillside Strangler, Anthony D'Amato, a.k.a. Ken Bianchi, stays in prison. Do not let this convicted killer of girls and young women out of prison.